My name is Stéphane Bouchard, and I'll be doing the talk in English, but I can answer every question in French, because I'm francophone. I think it's interesting that my talk comes at the last one, because it probably offers some wrap-up of what was presented earlier today, and it saves me some time, because I don't have to go over the great work that my two preceding colleagues already did. Okay, so brief overview of the talk. I'll give you a really brief introduction of what virtual reality is, because I don't want to repeat what Barbara said, but I think I'd just like to add a few details that probably answer the questions of why a video would not work. Then try to cover the usefulness of VR, and then get to the mechanism that we think, or some of the mechanisms that we think are involved in VR. And then some conclusions and ideas. And I have to note that I don't have any conflict of interest. So just to give you a background of what I'm doing, I'm a clinical psychologist. I was trained in CBT, doing virtual reality, doing CBT for anxiety disorders, especially panic disorder. And now we have a lab in our clinic, or we have a clinic in our lab, where we do treat patients using virtual reality 35 hours a week. So it's not science fiction anymore. There's VR, the Virtually Better Clinic, for example, that works exactly the same way as we do. We're funded by research. I'm happy enough to be funded by the Canada Research Chairs, so I have some luxury there. We do treat patients suffering from specific phobias using VR, fear of heights, spiders, fear of flying. We do panic disorder with agoraphobia, social anxiety. We're developing environment for PTSD, GAD, and OCD. And we're trying to do a few studies using body image and eating disorder. We are running a study with Loto Quebec on gambling. And we do, obviously, some clinical training and research. So I have the chance of being able to do both a developer of virtual environment, a clinician, and a researcher all blend together. And to give you an idea of what it looks like, again, some other technologies we have had mount displayed at was described early on. This is the Virtually Better system that we have. We tried to buy their material because it's one of the most reliable ones. And, for example, the patient could be seated here in the airplane seat, and the therapist, which is me here, I'm just sitting beside her, but that's just for the photo shoot, because actually I have to be sitting in front of the computer so I can see what's going on, and I can talk to her because she's wearing these headphones. But that gives you an idea. To define what virtual reality is, VR is an application that lets the user navigates and interacts with a three-dimensional computer-generated environment in real time. So VR is cooler. It's much cooler, actually, than IMAX theater, but it's also much worse. Let's look at the two examples. If you've been into an IMAX theater, one thing that happens in almost every movie, at some point, they will bring you close to a cliff, and they'll jump. And then you have the impression that you're falling. I don't know if you've had this experience in an IMAX theater, but they do that a lot because they know that the customers like it. It works because it's such a huge screen that you'd be tempted to crisp your hand and hold onto the chair. So that's cool. One drawback with IMAX theater and any other movies is if you don't want to jump, you will jump. Because the guy who made the movie decided that you will jump. In virtual reality, the field of view is much smaller. Around like that, we'll see different applications. But if you don't want to jump, you will never jump, because you are the person in charge of what's happening. And that's why a video wouldn't work, because if you want to change position, and from the bus example, if you want to see the bus coming from the other side of the street, you could do that in virtual reality. You can't do that in a video, because the video is already shot and done. So it's this interaction, it's this interactivity here that makes the big difference between video and other technologies. Immersion as well, we try to use in the lab a definition that doesn't involve any technology. So every technology could be called VR as long as it's interactive, 3D environments, and it's immersive enough. What would be the advantages of using VR as opposed to just doing it in real life? Well, some control over the stimuli. You may not see it very well, But this plane is going in directions of turbulences. And as a therapist, if I would be doing therapy for fear of flying, I'd like to have the control on what I'm going to put my patient through. And if we have a flight today and it's loaded with turbulences, you may not like your experience very much. Plus, you have to take into account the fact that you'll have to pay your flight ticket plus mine. So these are some of the advantages. Another example is the availability of the stimuli. We're running a study with children and adolescents who are afraid of talking in front of the classroom. What do you do when you need to do exposure with a 9-year-old child that wants to do exposure in front of the classroom? Because you need a classroom, that's doable. But if you're not working in the classroom, in the school, you don't have access to classrooms, first. Second, you don't want an empty classroom like this one. You need a classroom that is filled with people, and you want the classroom that's filled with children that will respect confidentiality, will not throw paper at your patient when he's practicing, will not laugh at him, or will laugh at him or her only when you are ready for that. That's a nightmare for a therapist. It's quite easy in virtual reality. Security and confidentiality. Well, I've never seen any case report of patient falling in fear of heights, but everyone is afraid of it. Every time I train a therapist or one of my interns and we have to do exposure of heights, they have to find a pretty high place and get there. And all the time, the first question the students will tell me, what happened if he falls? Well, he won't fall. But let's say he falls. Well, you're screwed. But take some precautions. But in virtual reality, that's no problem. You will never fall off a bridge. Well, actually, you can jump out of the bridge. But you're just going to fall from your feet to your feet because you're just standing in the room here. So that's quite safer. Get back. Back. And confidentiality. Confidentiality is often another issue. For example, if you are doing any kind of therapy where you have to get out of your office as a therapist, that means that every time you go out of the Douglas with someone at 3 o'clock every day, that someone is your patient. So a breach of confidentiality, quite obviously. And say your patient is suffering from gambling problems or drinking problems. So every time you go at 3 o'clock in a bar with someone and you're not drinking and you're offering him alcohol, that's a problem with confidentiality that could easily be solved with virtual reality because you'd be in the office. Okay. So, some other examples. That's why something left over. Some other examples. Some outcome studies now. Fear of flying. We never talked about fear of flying this morning or today. So this is one of the first study and a group of studies actually done by Dr. Rothbaum. And this, to give you a context, there's about 50 to 60 outcome studies published on the efficacy of virtual reality for the exposure of an anxiety disorder. Out of that, at least two-thirds of the studies are not good, some of mine included. Why? Because when you get a grant, you need to build a damn virtual environment, and that's long. And as you know about computers, there's always surprises and bugs you have to fix, and it takes longer than you expected. So at the end of the day, or at the end of the year, you had to invest two-thirds or most of your grant money to develop the virtual environment. So you're left with not that much money to run the great randomized controlled trials that we all want. So that's why there's so many studies that are seen of like pilot studies, and then we ran out of funds, but we're trying to get more funds to do more. But that's why you see several so-so studies. It's not because all the researchers couldn't care less about quality of their research. It's just because they're out of cash. But fortunately, there are some excellent or outstanding studies, and this is definitely one of them. If you compared, in this study, they compared virtual reality exposure as opposed to standard exposure, which meant going to the airport, for example, and a waiting list control. And what you see is from pre-treatment to post-treatment, there's a significant reduction in both treatments, no change in the waiting list, and no significant change between the two treatments. The follow-up, obviously the 6 and 12-month follow-up, they treated the waiting list. But again, you see No significant relapse at the 12 months follow-up and no significant difference between in virtual reality exposure and in vivo exposure. And you can do that with several measures, flight, post-treatment flights, at the follow-up, there's tons and tons of measures. And they did that once, and I was told that it was so thrilled by the study, the results, that he did a second study. So there's another study that was published with a totally separate sample that just confirms exactly the same results. It works, and it works very well. Another group that did one great study is from Paul Emmelkamp from Europe. And what they did is, again, they compared virtual reality versus in vivo exposure. But in that study, one of the nice elements is the virtual environment is a replica of the physical reality. So you have exactly the same environment. Which one is the real? But actually, one of them, I think that's the real one, and that's the virtual reality copy in Netherlands of a stair that you can go up. They have four or five places like that. Alex Bullinger in Switzerland did also the same thing, where you have exactly the same stimuli in virtual reality and in vivo. And again, what you see is pre-to-post change, no significant interactions. The effect size is so weak that there's no chances that even if you double or triple the sample size, you get anything significant. And maintenance of the gain at post-treatment. And depending on the measure, you're going to see the same thing again. So interestingly, in that study, you have the same stimuli. One is virtual, one is in vivo. And again, no difference. Some people would say, well, if there's no difference, why bother? Well, then you get control, then you get confidentiality, then you get all the things I mentioned earlier, and that's one, I think these are several good points. The other thing that we need to discuss about when we talk about virtual reality and outcome studies is, as a researcher, myself included, we began by boring stuff. I did several studies with fear of spiders, and everyone would say, why bother using the virtual spiders when you could just get out and grab a spider outside on the land and do the exposure? But as a researcher, I have to say that I need to start with control treatment, control stimuli, things that are doable and easy treatments. I mean, fear of spiders is easy because you can technically compare the virtual spider with a physical spider, and the treatment is not that complex. 5, 6, 7 hours of exposure once a week, that's a piece of cake. Low comorbidity, low severity. When you get to the more complex anxiety disorders, it's much more interesting for therapists. But as a researcher, things are getting more complicated because now we have to deal with comorbidity. We have to deal with more complex. If they can think about PTSD, their results are great, but don't forget that the patients were also probably comorbid with substance abuse, depression and stuff like that. So the treatment is much more difficult to do, and the effect specifically attributable to the virtual reality exposure is more difficult to detect because it's blended with all the other elements that you need to put in the virtual environment treatment, in the treatment. So why we have so many studies with specific phobias is for good scientific reasons. And now we're moving into the field of PTSD with more complex anxiety disorders and virtual environment that will probably be useful or more clinically useful for therapists. So few studies with more complex anxiety disorders is panic disorder with agoraphobia, group by Cristina Borea in Spain, where what they did is they compared virtual reality, in vivo exposure, and waiting list. But then you have a complete CBT package, so cognitive restructuring is included, and so on. And what you see is the same thing that you'll find in most results, most outcome study on VR, is no significant difference between virtual reality and in vivo exposure, higher, much better than the waiting list, and significant improvement that are maintained at follow-up. So now we're moving in the realm of more complex anxiety disorders with the same results, but at least we can also back up our results that we have from the specific phobia domain. Treatment of social anxiety and social phobia. You see here, this is a screenshot or a little video that comes from the fear of public speaking virtual reality environment. It was developed by Virtually Better. These are the screenshots that were developed by Evan Klinger in France. And as a therapist, I can control what will happen. That's something I can't do in real life. So that's one advantage. And if you compare, that study has several drawbacks. That is the first one. We now have a CIHR grant, and we're doing it with control and follow-up and so on. But as a preliminary study, if you look at the effect size, you probably can't see it from where you are. But if you look at the effect sizes, we would have needed about 300 to 400 patients to detect a significant difference. So the effect size are really small if you compared virtual reality plus standard exposure. And if we would have had 400 patients, virtual reality might have been or would have been more effective. So it's slightly more effective for VR, but it's way too small to be significant. But if you see it the opposite, it's clearly not less effective. Children. That's a nice study that we're trying to publish somewhere. We did with children. And the idea, and everyone that I talked to last night said, oh, yes, VR, but VR will be cool with children. Children would like virtual reality because, you know, it's their world, and it's probably then probably more enticing and would bring them to the clinic and so on. So cool. So we run that study where the point where we wanted to assess if children would be more motivated toward therapy. So there was not an efficacy study. It was a study on motivation. Would children be more motivated to receive exposure when it involves virtual reality or when it involves actually seeing a real tarantula about that size? And what you see here is the outcome results. So So what you will get is this is the pre and post. We have pre-treatment, 4 therapy sessions, either only the live tarantula or only the virtual reality spiders. And then we did a behavioral avoidance test, a BET. So there was one session that one measured is about 2/3 of the treatment. And then they had one last session. They had one last session where they would all do in vivo. And it works. This is not the problem. What is fascinating is the motivation. If you look at motivation, this is the motivation for children when they receive virtual reality and in vivo early on in treatment. There's no significant difference, but virtual reality was not more fun for the children. Surprisingly, we were a little bit surprised or shocked, because here this is not significant again, but still, you'd expect children to be more inclined to do VR exposure, and that's not the case. We have an hypothesis that we want to test this summer about on that, is when we did the debriefing after the study, every children that were facing the live tarantula, they all told us that they were glad they didn't have to do the virtual reality. So we're kind of shocked. We thought it would be cool. They were glad because they were afraid of what the virtual spider could do and how big it could be. And that's a problem for us therapists, is we just sold the treatment as we would do with adolescents and adults. Come and do, and you're going to learn, and you're going to expose yourself, and blah, blah, blah. But children have a pretty strong imagination. And we forgot to take that into account when we offered the treatment to the children. And we want to test that this summer to make sure that it's right. So if you want to go this summer by June, July, and August, if you have children and you go to the Montreal Science Museum, there will be an exhibit where we're going to run the VR environment. And if you have children, you're more than welcome to be subjects in our study. But we want to see if, depending on the age, apprehension changes. But it makes sense. Adults, and probably adolescents, assume that the therapists are not bad guys. We're here to help, and we're going to help them face their fear progressively. 9-year-old kids don't see it exactly that way. They've played these games with huge monsters that are falling from the sky. And they would probably expected that that's what would happen in the virtual environment. So I think with children, it may be more interesting and more enticing for them, but we need to present it differently because we need to be worried about their imagination. But unpredicted results, and I like that when it doesn't confirm the hypothesis. PTSD, we've been over that, so I will not go over that. You've got the bus world, 9/11, motor vehicle accident, a group in Ireland, Professor Walsh is using off-the-shelf game, driving games to put virtual, to put patients in the driving situations. And you have the military, so you have the military with Vietnam, we talked about that, we've seen some screenshots from the Angola and the Iraq. I'm going to skip the video, we've seen these. Next one. We've seen these results as well, so I'm glad. But VR for PTSD, there's also some other applications that might be useful. For example, stress management training. Now people are trying to see if we can use virtual reality to prepare soldiers to better deal with stress. So we'd be happy if we could treat them, but we'd probably be happier if we would not develop PTSD. So the group from Wiederhold, Melba Stets, we're just getting into that now. So that's virtual me. I'll come to that in the conclusion. But we're trying to work with the Canadian Armed Forces to develop a package where we could help the boys do male stuff, which is actually learning how to control your breathing and do relaxation, but in virtual reality, which probably fit more with their virility kind of type than just doing in a psychologist's office. We can discuss about that. And there's virtual training. Dr. Rizzo now is new fun. Is to develop virtual Justina. Justina is a patient, and she's a patient who's suffering from PTSD, but she could be a military patient. And she could be interviewed by a doctor or a psychologist, and you can supervise the interviewer and see if they're picking up the fine cues that they need to pick up, either for the assessment or the treatment. So we'll see some small shots. So that's someone in training.
Hello, my name is Dr. Davis.
Hello.
What brings you into the office today?
Something bad happened that night.
Sorry to hear that. Can you tell me what happened?
I was in the car with Eddie, and he stopped the car and wanted me to kiss him. But when I tried to stop him, he threatened me with a knife.
When did this happen to you, Justina?
I was so scared. I thought I might die.
It must have been very tough for you.
Yeah, it still is.
So you see the point here, whoopee, I'll stop her. So you see that the point here is that you can see how the doctor is interacting, and if some missing some cues, now he's getting some support, but if you do exposure, for example, and someone starts crying, and then you say, okay, now can you tell me more about how you feel? And you get to this humanistic kind of intervention in the middle of an exposure session. That's not the way to go. There are some cues that, as we discussed earlier, you would need to be watchful for avoidance, several cues like that. And Naomi just presented how, for example, that patient was avoiding when he was looking at the bus. It'd be nice if we could do that in the training of the psychiatrist or psychologist. And now this is one of the first version of Justina, but they're hoping to get really complex voice recognition and interaction and social interaction with Justina. Next. So to move to other applications, eating disorder. We've talked a lot about anxiety disorders. Eating disorder might be interesting. Obesity is a major problem now. And people who are suffering from eating disorder oftentimes have problems with their self-image and body image. There is one study, for example, I'm just picking up a few studies because there's so many in the field of VR. But this is 30 women who were suffering from eating disorder, and they were exposed to several virtual reality environments, and they measured the anxiety and their depression. The point is you expect that, imagine that you're suffering from anorexia, and you're on a beach wearing a bathing suit, and then you get to these people, and these people look at you like that. How will you feel, assuming that you are in a bathing suit? You don't have to be in the therapist's office, but you can think you are. How do you react to that? If you get in a restaurant and you're offered a different kind of food, what kind of food would you pick up first, and how do you react to cheesecake as opposed to carrots? And they showed that anxiety, there was a significant increase in anxiety and depression in situations that would be challenging for people suffering from eating disorder. So that's something we need to show. We need to show that the people are reacting to our virtual environment. Another small study we did in our lab where we looked at people who were preoccupied. There's about 4 or 5 studies done already on people suffering from an eating disorder. But what about those who are not clinically suffering from an anxiety disorders, but don't really like their body shape and are worried about what they look like? We got exactly the same thing here, preoccupied and non-preoccupied. And when they're in the pool, you have this woman here, and you have a woman, how can I say that politely in English? Less than. She's fat. And so you get there, and then she looks at you, and then she's unhappy because you... So you have the challenge between the beautiful one and the less beautiful one, and you have to take to discuss with them and look at them and interact with them, and they're looking at you like that. So either way you're caught, because you're either thinking that the nice-looking one is jealous of you, or otherwise you think that the other one is probably thinking that you're too thin. There's no way to get out of this. And we see a significant increase in anxiety, and stronger in front of the pool than the restaurant. And the treatment seems to work. They included that in a group by Giuseppe Riva in Italy, Milan, Italy, included this technology in their package for the treatment of obesity. It's a complex package, so that's now it become difficult to know which ingredient is effective. And they're publishing on several samples. So I just picked one up that was available last time I prepared the talk. This is not out of 50 patients, but then the final sample is about 200 patients, and they have a control condition. And control, pre, post, and waiting list. And you see that if you add that to the treatment, you're better able to target body image problems, which is a problem actually in therapy, in CBT, with people suffering from eating disorder. Other application, again, from Virtually Better is stuttering. If you know about stuttering, one significant challenge for stutterer is actually to talk when they're stressed. Because when you're stressed, your breathing pattern changes, and that increases the stuttering level. So several OTC or occupational therapists would tell you that it's easy or relatively easy to help stutterers to learn to talk differently and respect their breathing pattern. But it's much more difficult when they're surprised at the restaurant and someone has asked them for more coffee, or where they have to do a job interview. So in this environment, there's a challenging job interview where you're seeing the big boss, the big CEO of company, who is a little kind of cold when he talks to you. He warns you that when you're going to talk to him, you may be interrupted because he has an important phone call to take. And let's go, let's do this and that. And he's not really, not really nice, at least in the interview. Because the guy is a nice guy in the physical reality. And then you have the facilitative job interview where you see this woman at the back of her corridor when she has a crappy office. She's definitely low in the food chain. You know, in terms of high quality, you have the CEO who's like big shot, and then you have the woman with drawers and no painting and nothing. And what they saw is significant difference in stuttering when people have to do a job interview where they're being interviewed by someone or virtual someone who's stressful, as opposed to a virtual someone who isn't. Pretty cool, because now we're moving away from specific phobias to other domains of applications. Sexual preferences. That's another quite interesting topic. My colleague, Patrice Renaud, is working in Gatineau, but also at Pinel. Virtual agents or avatar, virtual people to make it simple, can be used to elicit positive emotions in the user, such as attraction. For example, so I want to have to warn you that there's a naked woman on the next slide, so those who might be offended, you need to close your eyes until I'm done. But the point is, we can do some eye tracking in the virtual environment, and we can see where you're looking at. So there's no round there. There's this naked woman in the bedroom, and I'll just start the demo again. But there's this naked woman in the bedroom, and we use an eye-tracking system that tracks where you're looking at in the virtual environment, and we can know what you're interested in, where you look. Are you looking at the sexual portion of her body, or are you paying more attention to her knees or to her feet or whatever? Nice and cool. Much more fascinating if you think about pedophiles. So that's a summary of the results. We blacken here. This is the blue boxes are just for the sake of not showing off sexual organs of children. But what we do have in the lab, this is an early version, though they're not really beautiful as in a virtual agents. But what you do have is virtual woman adults, virtual male adults, and virtual children naked, boys and girls. And now you can look at the eye gaze pattern and see where people are looking at and how they're looking at. So these are two different things. So that's a normal heterosexual. This is a normal heterosexual scan path. So you see the blue. The more you focus on an area, it is getting more and more blue. But the red are the lines where people are looking at. And you see that, say it's me. So it's not me, but let's assume it's me. If I'd be looking at a female child, usually I would probably scan the environment with my eyes. And unfortunately, my eyes would probably cross some of her sexual areas. I mean, I have two daughters at home, and when they get out of the bath, I'm sorry, but sometimes I see some of their genitalia. It happens. But that's normal because I don't focus on it. So you would see some eyes looking at sexual portions, so it's not a big deal. What is interesting is you can see that I would be focusing at the face because that's where we usually focus when we look at people. We often look at or focus at the face and the hands. So you'd see that I look away, but mostly at the face. I look around. But if I'm looking at a naked woman, I would definitely look at her face, but it might happen that I won't be looking only at the face. And there's hard data to show that. And then if I be a pedophile, say I'm a pedophile, that's the scan path of a pedophile. The pedophile, they're normal, he's looking at the children, but the pedophile, you see two things. They focus everywhere. So you look at the scan path, it's everywhere, especially on the chair. Who could care about the chair? It's probably avoidance pattern. Plus, it's everywhere, but it's still focusing on the genitalia. So what if I'd be a pedophile, I would probably look at what I want to look, but then I would look away, not to be caught. So I'll look away and I get back, look away and get back, look away and get back. So it's not only focusing, but the pattern, the eye gaze pattern. And that's quite more robust than the ABIL procedure when we do the penalty lunte, two minutes. Thanks. So we now in a lab here in Gatineau or here in Montreal are testing pedophiles and sex offenders to see where they're looking at, and we're doing exactly the same thing with the penile tumescence. And there's another version of the system for females where we have the diode in the vagina. Other applications, schizophrenia. Wow, there was a debate 4 or 5 years ago whether we should use virtual reality for schizophrenics. There's two ways to see it. If you think first, schizophrenics have a problem dealing with reality. They see things that are not there. Is it ethical to put them in a virtual environment where they will believe another reality? They already have problems dealing with a real reality. What happens when you present to them a virtual reality? Will they getting more hallucinated and more dysfunctional? Some people were afraid, yes. The other way to see it is if you look at the therapist and what they do with the schizophrenics, even therapists that are not CBT, they talk to the patient and they try to tell them that what they believe is not true. CBT therapists do that probably more often, but still. So it might be interesting to put schizophrenics in a virtual environment so they see things that are not there. And then they have to learn that reality is subjective. There's no real reality. There's a physical reality, and there's what you perceive. And if you perceive this thing that looks really, really, really real, but it's not real, maybe you can apply the same reasoning to your delusions. You think you're Elvis, but you don't look like Elvis. You don't sing like Elvis, and there's no one at your show. maybe it's just an illusion, just like the virtual reality, and we need now to test your judgment about reality. So it might become a tool. And actually, there's groups now. There's one study, most of these studies are done either in Asia or in UK. But I'm sure there are probably other people running studies right now. But in UK, what they did is they put schizophrenics suffering, people suffering from schizophrenia in normal control in a virtual environment. That was a subway, a tube, that they say, as they say in London. And that's the tube, the London tube, and the virtual people were not moving. So they tried it easy. So they were not talking against the real people. But when they compared the difference between the clinical participants and the non-clinical participants, there's no significant difference in terms of increase in hallucination and delusions. People looked at the virtual people, they said, ooh, maybe they're talking about us, but we had the same rate of worries among the users, whether they were schizophrenics or not. And there was no significant side effect afterwards. There was no increase in their schizophrenia on the following days. So there's a safety study that showed that you can put virtual people, that you can put schizophrenics in a virtual environment. Another group of study, which is done by, Kwang-guk is his first name because it's hard to know which Kim it is. So Kwang-guk Kim in Korea did a study where they compared the schizophrenic people in normal controls in different scenarios where they're focusing at negative symptoms and how schizophrenic would deal with negative symptoms, and if they have, for example, to refuse a friend's query or to deal with conflicting problem situations in a virtual environment. So it's safe. You know what's happening. You can control the stimuli. You're able not to put too much pressure on the schizophrenic patient, but still you can see that. And they saw that, as expected, schizophrenic perform less well than normal controls, and now the next step is to use it in treatment. Other application, ADHD. I'll try to stop this for a second. Yeah. ADHD, that's a work by Skip Rizzo. You might have heard about that. It's a virtual classroom. One of the problems when we looked at ADHD, when we try to assess hyperactive children, is we oftentimes either use paper and pencil tests, that's fine, or we use, for example, continuous performance tests, CPT. But the CPT would ask you to look on the computer, and when you see two letters, say A followed by X, push that button. And when A followed by something else and X, push another button. So you want to see how they're able to maintain their attention. The problem is that's done in a control environment. Classroom is not a control environment. How what you find in the CPT relates to the physical reality, it's difficult to know. In virtual reality, you can do the CPT, so I'll go over the video for us in a sec, but you can do the CPT, continuous performance task, but you can standardize distractors. For example, you'll see this is the classroom, and what you see is what the children would be seeing in a virtual environment. Oopie-doo. You hear my computer thinking. He does bzzz. So the teacher is in the front. You have the letters A and X, and all the letters appearing here. You would have to push the button just like the normal CPT, but you have sounds, people coughing. Not only that, the professor is moving. Someone is throwing a paper here. Then a bus will come, and a bus will come at exactly the same moment for every subject so you can standardize it. The bell will ring. Someone would get into class and will leave. You have other cars. You have beautiful cars. You have boring cars. You have all the things that are actually happening in a real physical environment. So you have a CPT that is probably more ecologically valid than those we do on the computer. So these are the statistics. I'll show you the behavioral results in a sec. But these are the statistical results. ADHD children as opposed to control. As expected, more omission, more commissions in the ADHD children as opposed to normal control. That would be expected because they're suffering from ADHD. What is cool to see is the behavioral data. What you will see is the recording of the head of the normal control subject. So that's the head. So that's the head under normal control, and that's the head of the children suffering from ADHD. It's a 7-minute video, but it's cut, so you'll see different pieces. So someone is walking. You see he's got distracted. He got distracted as well. That's fine. Remember that the task is to do the CPT. He watched the car. He was able to ignore it. Someone is walking, same person twice. He ignores it because it's the same person. He can't ignore it. They're still doing the CPT, so he's probably collecting more errors now than the other one. And then, after 4 or 5 minutes, oh, the car again. Same car. Ooh, what a beautiful car. Ooh. Oh, no car is the other side. Oh. He's getting a little tired, that's fine. But you kind of feel that he's more tired than the other one. Again. And again. And then someone is throwing a paper. Just before that. I'm not working with kids, but I think my diagnosis is clear already. Someone is showing a plane. Ooh, nice plane. Ooh, tiles. 1 tiles, 2 tiles, 3 tiles, 4 tiles. Oh, yeah. Ooh, I'm doing CPT. Now forget about it. 6 tiles, 7 tiles, 8 tiles. Ooh, a car. CPT again. Oh, no. Just try to figure out the power of this diagnostic tool. Dr. Rizzo is now working with the Psych Corporation to test that and make it available as a tool for assessment of the ADHD. But just like Dr. Justman presented earlier, we're now using virtual reality to try to have more ecologically valid testing situations and rehab situations. Other clinical applications, substance abuse. Substance abuse, one of the big problems with substance abuse is if you look at Barlat study and all of these other studies, at some point we would need to put the patient into situations of temptation. So you want to elicit the craving and have the patient learn to deal with it. Because any alcoholic is pretty good at controlling himself in my office at 11 o'clock in the morning, which is much more difficult when they are in a bar with loaded with people, and then they have a scotch in their hand, and then they have to cope with refusing it or not. So you want to put them, you want to arouse the emotions so people stop thinking with their prefrontal and they start thinking with their heart, as they would say, or with the limbic system. And then it is getting more interesting. So this is the environment from Virtually Better for marijuana, for alcohol craving. This is the environment from the Spanish team for gambling, for tobacco use, for a crack house. There's pretty solid data that are showing that when you put people in a virtual environment and then you present cues, this is for smoking, but smoking cues in social interactions and an increase in cravings that decreases afterwards. So it does elicit craving, that Bordnick's work. Now, what can we do with it in therapy? These are other examples from Steve Bauman. When you have other cue situations, Virtually Better's crack house, our gambling situations that are in development in Gatineau. And there's even more applications. For example, anger management. For anger management in the treatment, you need to do exposure therapy. You need to piss your patient off. Try to do that with a 6-foot-tall guy. And if you're not 6 feet tall, and if you're black tie in Taekwondo, that's fine. But otherwise, most of my students and interns are afraid to do that, obviously because the guy is aggressive. But you have to do that. You have to do the exposure because they have to learn to control themselves. You can do that in virtual reality. If they punch someone, they're going to punch thin air. Autism, pain control. We've talked about Hunter Hoffman. He did a lot of studies on pain control. Neuropsych assessment, Dr. Joshman talked about that. And there's even more and more and more applications. So let's try to talk about mechanism. Why would it work? And I'm going to focus on the mechanism for anxiety disorders, because I think the mechanism might be different from one disorder to another. And I think some of the issues that I will raise today are totally irrelevant for other applications. First, one common question you probably have in your mind is more hardware necessary? Do you need more cool toys? And all the computer engineers I've worked with are all convinced the answer is yes. As a psychologist, I'm convinced the answer is no. My colleagues, computer engineers, when they do research, for them, emotion is error of measurement. People are not reacting exactly the same way. For me, psychologists, emotions are not error of measurement. That's the point. That's what I want to measure. So we are looking at how can we measure and deal with emotions, and would that have an impact? So there's a study done by Muhlberger in Germany where they compared a fear of flying, their own fear of flying program, and what they did is they had this expensive hydraulic system, so when we take off and land, it would follow the airplane movement. Much cooler than the Virtually Better system. We have the Virtually Better system in our lab. Every time a journalist come, they'd say, wouldn't it be cooler if when you take off and land, it would do this and that. It only vibrates. They're not psychologists. You don't need cool toys. You need effective toys. What they showed is, it's more cool, fine. But there's if you use the system that follows movement or not, there's no significant difference in outcome. The treatment is not more effective. If you're working for Disney World and Disneyland, you need cool things. If you're a psychologist, you need effective tools. You need to understand what you're doing. And you don't need that because this is much more expensive. It'll break even more often than just Windows. And it doesn't give you a thing more. You need to have the right cues that trigger the emotions. And movement is probably not. As Dr. Rothbaum said, sound and shake is one. And what you see and what you don't see in the airplane are. And the guy that keeps pushing on the bell sound and ding, 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 ding like that, that's a bugger. Plus, when they retract the wheels and you get, you think that a piece of the airplane is falling. These are good cues. So, moving airplane seats, useless. Cool, but useless. Let's push it a little bit harder. In a study in Switzerland, they did something awful. They had social phobic, and they put the social phobic in a virtual environment where the people, the virtual people, are absolutely bad design. Well, graphically bad. It's just eyes. So forget about the mouth, forget about the body, it's just eyes. So the environment is filled with a crowd with just eyes. What do you see? Significant increase in anxiety when people get an environment with just eyes as opposed to not social phobic. Come to think of it, social phobics are not afraid of people's knees and feet. Social phobics are afraid of what other people think, and you would detect that mostly by how other people look at you. So they have the right cue. It's maybe not the most or the best virtual environment, but it's sufficient enough to induce anxiety. So you may not need perfect realism. You may just need what matters for that disorder. Another great study that didn't turn out the way they expected. This is from Zimmern and a group in the States, and what they did is they wanted to see the graphics quality of the virtual environment. Should we need to have, you know, shaders and when you move you see your shadow behind you and reflections, all these cool things. And they did that, fine, and their control situation was the cheapest you could get. It's called wireframe. It's just black and white lines. So in terms of graphics quality, it's very bad. And the people in this environment, that's a picture of the person, and that's what they would see. And this is called the pit paradigm, or the pit experiment. It's you would learn to throw balls from here to a target. And when you've learned to throw the virtual balls on a target, then we open the door, and you physically walk into the second portion of the room, which is actually a pit, to the room below. And now you have to throw the balls on the room below. So you have physical things you throw, and you throw them on the target, which is one story below. So that's the task. And they realized that environment was the best. Fine, that's good for graphics. engineers. What struck me when I read that is, for example, the measured heart rate. And this is the heart rate of all the conditions, just the grid, all the colors, but that's just people who just have the black and white grid, just the really poor graphics quality black and white grid. And there's a significant increase in heart rate from the pre-pit to when they go in the pit. So the cheapest graphics quality you can get is black and white with just lines. And even then, there's a significant increase in heart rate. Okay, it's better in the other one, fine, but think like a brain in the amygdala and how the brain reacts. How do you perceive death? Depth perception is converging lines. If you have perspective, it means it's high. If it's high, you might fall. And the amygdala, the emotional part of the brain, doesn't have 2 million years of evolution to understand that that's virtual. They see converging lines, it means it's dangerous. If it's dangerous and you're too close to it, increase in heart rate. That's how the brain works. And that's what they found. And I think it's quite fascinating if you look at the realism to see that really bad realism is sufficient to increase heart rate. I'm not saying that we should aim at low-quality virtual environment. I'm saying that we should not criticize low-quality environment because they're doing just what they have to do. And we just messed a little bit with that, and we look in two studies in anxiety and presence. Dr. Joshman mentioned about anxiety. And we did that study because several studies are correlating anxiety with the feeling of presence, the illusion that you're there in a virtual environment. What we found in that study, we took snake phobics. We asked people who are afraid of snakes to visit this virtual environment, which is actually pyramids with desert, in the desert. You have sands, and these are screenshots. And we manipulated the information. So people saw both times exactly the same virtual environment. But in one situation, we told them, go ahead and visit. It's no worries. In the other condition, we said, be careful. It's filled with poisonous and dangerous snakes. They're lurking everywhere. They might bit you. You won't see them, but they're everywhere. So actually, it wasn't true. But if you think like a psychologist, you obviously know that if you put phobics in an environment that you tell them it's filled with snakes, you're going to increase anxiety. So what we did is we measured anxiety, and then we inflated anxiety by giving some instructions, and then we did the opposite, sort of counterbalance situation. And we look at presence. So manipulation check, yes, anxiety increased when it was supposed to, and then decreased in the other situation, and it's a counterbalance, so you get the other effect. If you look at presence, we had a significant increase, and people were significantly more present when they're more anxious. Cool. That means if people are more anxious, they believe more in a virtual environment. Getting back to the airplane seat thing. In our lab, we don't have the hydraulics, but when a patient doesn't feel anxious enough, we just tell them that the pilot was drunk yesterday, and they had to repair the motor, and he just finished it, and now you're ready to go. And they're forecasting some turbulences. And we may be out of food, but definitely there is no alcohol on that flight. What you see an increase in anxiety, and when people are more anxious, they believe more in a virtual environment, and then it feeds back. So you can have the hydraulics, or you can just tell a good story. And psychologists were pretty good at telling good stories when it comes to exposure. We tried the other way around. We said, okay, if increasing anxiety increased presence, is the other way around true as well? So in that situation, fear of height people, and we have fear of height people, they were looking at a building, they would have to select which floor they would go out to, and then they would probably, for example, go out to the 13th floor, and then they would go out, and then they would walk on the kind of little outside on the small sideways, and they would walk on the side. So you see here, you're walking in about something that wide, and you can see down cars moving, and then you got to the exit, to the end where you have planks, and you have to cross the street on those scaffold planks, and planks are falling around, and then you have to turn yourself three times and come back. So that should induce anxiety. But in one condition, people were in a good or high immersion condition, and the other one were in low immersion condition. In the good immersion condition, we had more presence, and people actually wore the handheld display, but we turned the lights off in the room. We hide everything that would help them or allow them to see their surroundings. Everything was focusing on a virtual environment. In the other condition, lights were on, glow cloth around the head mount display, so they could see their physical body in our office. We put some rock music on. It was definitely not fitting with the virtual environment. We tried to make them remember that they're in a physical office, not in a virtual height situation. And when you do that, you get exactly the expected results. When you manipulate presence, you manipulate anxiety. So it is working both ways. It's a bidirectional correlation. You induce anxiety, you get more presence. You induce presence, you get more anxiety. So it is working both ways, and that's quite useful as a therapist. Let's get to the real question now. The high-end technologies, we're going to talk about that in the conclusion, but there's the head-mount display technology where you put the goggles on. The other technology is often called cave. A cave is a place where you stand in front of huge walls and images are projected behind it. So actually, if I'd be in a head-mount display right now, I would see you if you're a virtual audience, but if I do that with my hands, I wouldn't see anything because the goggles are blocking my view. And if I do that, I might hit here the podium because it's physical, but I don't see it. In a cave system, I would see you, but I would see myself in the virtual environment. And if I hit this, I wouldn't know where I'm looking at. So you can see it's much more enticing. We're comparing $1,000 system or technology to $1 million to a $2 million technology. And what they did, again, with Paul Amelkamp, is they show that if you use the cave technology, you get more presence than the head mount technology. That's no surprise. There's no significant difference in terms of outcome effectiveness. The treatment is more enticing, but it is as effective. So the $1,000 or $1 million thing, no difference. So why invest? Well, you have to go back again, and I'm joining the ideas that Dr. Rothbaum. We need to understand how the brain works and how people are reacting to fear. So that's kind of taken out of Ledoux's work and amygdala. But just want to focus on a few things. It's complex, but to summarize interaction in the brain, there's two steps. Within 12 milliseconds, the amygdala picks up the stimuli, and the anxiety reaction is starting. And then 7 milliseconds later, the information has been processed by the prefrontal cortex, and there's a feedback loop that would tell you, for example, that you got aroused for no reason. So there's a feedback between identification of stimuli, production of emotions and integration, and all these feedbacks within a few milliseconds. But what comes first is emotion. If you ever had a fight with your spouse or your parents, you probably know that emotions are not logical. When you try to have a logical argument when you're both emotionally aroused and pissed off or anxious, you don't think quite well. You don't think perfectly well. And that's quite obvious. And this is where I think we could play with virtual reality, is when the emotional part of the brain is kicking in initially first, ideally first, people don't think exactly the same way. They think as they would do in a physical situation, and they forget that it's a virtual situation. So that's one of my working hypotheses. You see here brain and a virtual head mount display, and you recognize the brain is open. You get a prefrontal, you get a limbic system here. So we assume, and that's one of the ideas we're working on, that if you present to a phobic something that he's afraid of, the presence would let the brain work as if the stimuli was real. If you think it's true, if you think you're really there, then what happens is exactly the same thing that would happen in a normal situation where actually the information would get to the limbic system, you would call the prefrontal react, and you get all the perceived efficacy and cognitions that are there, and you get all the automatic processing of threat-related cues that's encoded in the brain, and you get exactly the same processing as you would in a normal situation. Some hints that we're not too far from this. That's a study we did with fear of spiders. And as an outcome study, it sucks because there's only one group. It's pre-post only. But that was not planned as an outcome study. It was planned as a process study. And we looked at measures of change. And one of the measures we included is an emotional Stroop task. You know about the emotional Stroop task? The typical Stroop task is we would show you some letters or some words, and the ink would be, for example, the word blue would be written in an ink that is red, and you have to name the color. So there would be dual processing in your brain about the color and the word, and then that would slow you down when you name the stimuli. The emotional Stroop is exactly the same thing, but what you present then is not the color of the words on the monitor, on a computer monitor. What we would show, for example, is a spider, and you have to to let or to tell the 5 minutes? The bus is going to leave at 5:30? Okay, some bus will leave at 5:30 and others it's come back and the other, because I'm supposed to I will return because I'm supposed to finish at 5:30. I'm kind of running up. Okay, so I'll be finishing soon. So the idea of the emotional stroop task is you've got, say, unconscious processing of information. And what we did here is we presented people with slides of spiders, slides of cows. We assume cows are neutral stimuli. And we presented slides of rabbits. Rabbits are supposed to be positively emotional charged stimuli. And what you see is, well, the response time pre-treatment, if you compare the blank to the cow, to the rabbit, to the spider, is nothing surprising. This emotional stroop task quite useful. People take more time to name the color of the computer screen when they see a spider than when they see a cow. What is fascinating is post-treatment, you see a reduction. This effect disappears. We never addressed that, and this effect disappeared. Within milliseconds, it's exactly the same time they take post-treatment to name a chair or a cow or a rabbit that it takes to name the color that you see when you see a spider. It's pretty cool because we're getting probably to some mechanisms. So we try to predict the heart rate response when people are facing a live tarantula in a regression. And what we showed is there's two things that came out significant: change in beliefs and change in self-efficacy, and change in information processing with emotional stroop that was significant pre-post but was not a significant predictor. What does that mean? If you try to understand why someone is getting better in virtual reality, at least for spiders, is because they change their beliefs and they increase their self-efficacy. So that gives us some hints. Some working hypothesis, I'm going to skip that to go to what are the technological options available? How far do you need to go? I just said that a cave is useless for therapy, so why would I bother having a cave? Well, if you do research, it's quite different. But how do you integrate internet and everything that we've been talking earlier on? And, for example, the idea about Second Life, and you're putting in this virtual environment, how does all that blends? Well, I'd like to show you there's augmented reality. In augmented reality, you're seeing, for example, here, this is a patient who's afraid of cockroaches. But rather than creating a full virtual environment, they only created virtual cockroaches, and they add that to a live video feed of what you're actually seeing. So you're seeing, you're the patient, this is the hands of Cristina Botea in Spain, and the cockroaches would be walking on the counter, and you would see them because they were added on a video feed live of what you see out of your office. So it's quite faster to develop the virtual environment. So you have the cave system. That's an example of the cave system. You can see one of my grad students here. She's standing up, and all the images surrounding her are floating in front of her. So you have the impression that you can actually grasp things. Is it useful to get with a smell? We have a smell machine that we have smells that are matching the cues in the environment. Is that really useful? Or let's go to the big sci-fi thing. I think it will run smoothly. That's the six-wall cave we have in Gatineau. So images are projected from bottom up, from the top down, plus 360 degrees. So actually, when you get in a virtual environment in that cave system, and when you close the back door, right here, you get inside, and when you close the back door, wherever you're looking at, yeah, you are in the virtual environments, and things are floating in front of you. So as opposed to the head mount, what you see on just what's in the monitor, you see everything surrounding yourself, and you're getting really engulf or immerse totally in this environment. Is that useful for therapy? No. Well, we haven't tried it yet. I'm sure not. But if you want to do research to try to figure out why VR works and why presence, what's the role of presence, we have a perfect situation because now we don't have to worry about it's not good enough because it's pretty good enough. And if you're ever interested, there's a video conference system just in the door of that so we can do research from other sites. The other thing is virtual people. We saw yesterday evening the Second Life avatars. How realistic could we go or should we go? So we have a study now that we're starting how people relate to virtual people and how do they relate to virtual people when it's someone you know or when it's the image of someone you don't know. So the image, does it matter? And how does people relate to virtual people you know when they're expressing emotions? So this is mini-me, and that's Stéphane Bouchard in development, and this is me in the neutral phase, and these are copies of the Heckman, Paul Ekman's. We're working to try to replicate exactly the same emotions. So this is me happy, this is me with fear, this is me with sadness, this is me with some pain, and this is me with excruciating pain. Actually, you didn't torture me to get that. You just mapped this. But now this guy is working in the six-side cave. So you can talk with the physical me or the virtual me or virtual someone else, and we'd like to know how people react to people they know. So we could really see how far we could go. Actually, we could go to the point where you can probably leave your dreams. So I'm now in Star Trek. Also, that's a trick that the computer guy did, but I'm also now Spock or whatever. So the take-home messages, what would be the take-home messages? VR is useful for anxiety disorders, I'm referring to the previous talks, but for other applications as well. It's a pretty, pretty fast-developing field. Be careful, because VR is just a tool to accompany good therapy and good therapist skills. VR is bringing slightly more, but it's not radically changing treatment. You need a good assessment, a good therapeutic alliance. You need to understand the mechanisms behind the specific disorder you're working on, and then you could add VR. So it's just an add-on. And be careful also, because more details cause more expectation in a user. The closer we get to the physical reality, the more expectation people have towards their virtual environment. If it's really, really close to realism, to perfect realism, people will pick up on the small details that are missing and will comment negatively on that. If you just wireframe black and white, as we saw, it seems that it doesn't matter much. And the relationship with presence and realism may not be linear. We can discuss about that. And just want to acknowledge the rest of my team, because we need the whole lab to do that kind of research. And if you're interested to know more about VR, there's the Cyber Therapy Conference this year. It's in Verbania, Italy, close to Milan, and this is 14th edition. You better go this year, unless you're living in Asia, because the following year it's in Korea, Seoul, Korea. So it's a little bit further. So if you like Seoul, Korea, fine. Otherwise, I suggest you still have 2 days before we change the pre-registration to the full registration cost, and it's in June. Thank you very much.
So
you want for questions? You want to? My card is in the back. I'll give it to you at the end, if you don't mind. Want me to take questions, or we'll probably let people leave, and we'll see if some people stay.